hours that serves thousands of people every year. A big issue is that we don't have enough immigration lawyers, and we need additional immigration legal services funding from the city of New York. So making sure that we're following the laws that we currently have on the books, expanding where we can, and then making sure that we're investing in our communities. 43% of all workers in New York City are foreign born. 43%, 50% of small businesses are immigrant owned as well. So we need to make sure that we are ensuring that the safety and security of all these folks is protected by the city of New York.
We just have 30 seconds, but we wanted to ask you about this Chinese father and son, 6-year-old son, the father named Fei, the 6-year-old named Yuan Xuan, who were picked up by ICE. The father sent to an ICE jail. The son, the 6-year-old, no one knows where he is.
The father is currently in Orange County in detention. The son is in OR custody, which means that's where normally children who are unaccompanied, which is not the situation with this family. The Trump administration is continuing their family separation agenda, and we need to fight back against that as well.
Murata Walda, thanks so much for clarifying that. President and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, part of Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani's Committee on Immigrant Justice. That does it for our show. Tonight, I'll be in Sag Harbor on the east end of Long Island, where there will be a 7:30 screening of the film Steal This Story, Please, about Democracy Now! It's at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor. I'll be doing the Q&A afterwards with the filmmakers, Teal Lesson and Carl Deal. Check out our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
You're listening to our KBOO Fights Back campaign. Help KBOO reach our $75,000 goal by December 31st so we can bring you another great year of cutting-edge radio made by you, for you. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 to contribute today.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for new journey workers and their families in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship. Under the link, Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland State professor is suing the school. Is it a case of free speech or hate speech? Our Josh Salem takes an in-depth look. Immigrant rights groups in Oregon are holding town halls to teach people what to do when ICE shows up. And just a couple of cells instead of taking an animal's life. A new way to cultivate meat. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 4th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. A Portland State University professor has filed a lawsuit against PSU after the school put her on administrative leave. Like in similar cases, it appears it will highlight tensions between free speech and so-called hate speech. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
A Portland State University professor who has been on administrative leave since June says the university engaged in unlawful discrimination and retaliation against her. She has filed a tort claim against PSU. PSU placed Yasmin Hanouch on paid administrative leave on June 6th, after video footage emerged online showing her in conversation at a protest outside a Beaverton School District board meeting. Hanouch is allegedly seen telling a counter-protester, quote, "I am Hamas. We are all Hamas," end quote. In a claim filed yesterday, lawyers say Hanouch's words were sarcastic, taken out of context, and part of a private conversation. Hanouch is a tenured professor in charge of PSU's Arabic program. She allegedly attended the demonstration in support of a Beaverton School board member who was facing criticism for pro-Palestinian views on social media. Counter-protesters shouted Hamas at demonstrators speaking at the meeting, according to the claim. Her counsel said, quote, "It was in her personal capacity, on her personal time, that on June 2nd, 2025, Dr. Hanouch attended a Beaverton School District board meeting to support a board member who had been the subject of a targeted campaign of harassment for speaking out against the genocide of Palestinian people in Gaza, end quote. The claim also says council believes, quote, PSU discriminated against Dr. Hanoush based on her national origin and her protected First Amendment activity, off-campus conduct on her private time, speaking as a private citizen, end quote. The claim says the actions and non-actions taken by the university, including a public statement from the PSU president calling the video reprehensible, have caused harm to Hanoush's career and personal safety. A PSU spokesperson said the university cannot comment on the tort claim notice, but did confirm that Hanoush is still on administrative leave. An investigation into the incident is said to be ongoing. Since June, Hanoush's work email has apparently been flooded with hate mail and threats. Since a series of national student protests over the war in Gaza, many universities have taken steps to revise free speech policies. However, institutional treatment of students and faculty over free speech remains a source of great controversy, as the Trump administration has targeted several colleges for allowing what it calls anti-Semitism on campus. PSU's policies note that the First Amendment protects speech, quote, no matter how offensive its content, end quote, but that harassment, threats, and incitement to violence are exceptions. Hanoush has taught at Portland State since 2010. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Even some Republican members of Congress are starting to join Democrats in scrutinizing the boat strikes ordered by the Pentagon that have killed people that the Trump administration accuses of dealing drugs. Democratic Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter is among the many taking a strong stand against embattled U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Here she explains why.
Maxine Dexter, Oregon's third, checking in about the absolute lawlessness and incompetence of our president and his administration. Too many people in my district are struggling just to get by. They're working hard. They're playing by the rules. Who's not? Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth, and their cronies. They have launched an illegal act of war repeatedly in the Southern Caribbean with a war crime having been committed on September 2nd, where now we understand all people on a boat were instructed to be killed. That is a war crime. We don't know yet for sure if it was Pete Hegseth who gave that order, but regardless, it was an illegal order and nobody stood up for the rule of law. Pete, you gotta resign. You're incompetent and you don't belong in the place of defending our democracy, our country, or the rule of law.
And again, that was Oregon Congresswoman Maxine Dexter. And Oregon Governor Tina Kotek has announced she's running for re-election. She's also announcing her new plan to revive the economy, jobs, and business climate in Oregon. She gathered with leaders of a new coalition she's putting together from the business community this week.
We are here today to talk about Oregon's long-term prosperity. And there is no better place to talk about Oregon's economic future than here at a company that believes in Oregon's promise. Lam Research has recently announced $65 million investment in Oregon. Shows exactly what we're fighting for. Companies that choose to grow here, that create opportunity here, that see Oregon as a place to build what is next. So today, I am here to lift up and emphasize that Oregon is open for business. We are ready to roll up our sleeves to support business and create more good-paying jobs for Oregonians. The roadmap that I'm putting forth today reflects the perspectives of more than 350 businesses around our state, as well as Oregon's leading business associations and economic experts. This roadmap complements and builds on the work that we've been doing together to expand housing, to strengthen public education, to make sure there is more access to mental health and addiction care. These things and more good jobs are how we're going to make sure that Oregon is a livable, thriving place to be. Oregon's next decade can and will deliver extraordinary growth and real affordability if we act now is our opportunity. Today, we plant the seeds for long-term prosperity. We shape an Oregon where good-paying jobs are within reach for every Oregonian, where businesses that were built here can thrive, and new businesses that come here will see more success. So I want to be honest and talk about where we stand today. Oregon faces the same headwinds that are hitting other states: sluggish job growth, elevated unemployment, and declining population trends. And some of our homegrown businesses have left, and there is a lot of bureaucratic red tape that has been blocking critical investments. And on top of that, the federal chaos makes it worse. Ever-changing tariff policies threaten our businesses, deteriorating relationships abroad jeopardize our export partnerships, and steep federal budget cuts will make Oregon families poorer, sicker, and hungrier, pushing economic opportunity further out of reach. And these headwinds are strong, but I don't back down from challenges, especially when it comes to improving the well-being of Oregon and the prosperity of our state as a whole. We have to do this together, and that's what we're here today to talk about. Here's the good news. The foundation here in our state for economic growth here in Oregon is extraordinary. We're renowned for innovation and entrepreneurship. Our industries, from berries and hazelnuts and wheat to high tech and outdoor and athletic apparel, create opportunity statewide. Our workers are highly skilled and ready. Our research universities drive new ideas and technological advances. And our quality of life and natural beauty make Oregon not just smart for business, but a fantastic place to live, work, and raise a family. Now, we must bring our full potential to bear, working together to create an economy that does indeed work for everyone. By uniting around a statewide vision and working with our partners in the private sector and in the legislature, we can coordinate our talents and our assets. We can ensure that Oregon doesn't just keep up, but actually leads in sustained economic growth. So my prosperity roadmap has three goals. One, we want to grow our state economy faster than the national average. Two, we want to create more living wage jobs right now. And three, we want to attract new businesses and grow the ones that are already here. And there are specific goals in the document that's been handed out. To accomplish these goals, I think it's important to tap the expertise that is inside and outside our state to help deliver on these goals. I will be establishing the Governor's Prosperity Council, convening business and workforce experts to support the roadmap and advise me and my office on additional recommendations.
And we just heard from Oregon Governor Tina Kotek talking about reviving Oregon's economy. And at the national level, pocketbook issues of people in the Northwest are also on the mind of Washington U.S. Senator Patty Murray. She's worried about health insurance subsidies that are about to expire at the end of this year.
You know, we got to be real here. We are a month into open enrollment, a full month. The time to save people from these huge increases in costs they're going to see because the ACA tax credits expired was before these premium hikes were all but locked in. Saying, let's start talking about fixing this now, a month into open enrollment, instead of at any point earlier this year when we actually had time to stop premiums from skyrocketing or look at some of these different reforms. This is about as serious as expressing concern about RFK Jr.'s anti-vax crusade after voting to make him the most powerful public health official in the country. The time is out. Realistically, the only way now we can stop people from seeing these huge increases is a clean extension and a longer open enrollment. And I think we should be honest about that. I appreciate the ideas being tossed around, even if I have some concerns with some of the proposals. But if Republicans had come to the table at any point earlier this year, there would be time to sit down and talk about this. But we have now seen the Republicans run out the clock. They blew right past the start of the open enrollment. Forget about time spent negotiating. There is not time to implement anything more complicated than a clean extension. So if Republicans are serious about preventing the mega health care hike, they should work with us right now to pass a clean one-year extension as fast as possible, literally right now. And if their call for reforming tax credits is serious, we should look at that. We can talk about those reforms ahead of the 2027 year. But I have to say, I am not optimistic that most Republicans are serious about this, because they refuse to talk about this problem before right now. And I've been down this road before. During the Trump administration, the first one, I sat across from Chair Alexander. We hammered out a bipartisan plan to lower costs. We were on the 1 yard line. And then a call came down from Trump and Republican leaders. They did not want us to get to a deal. They didn't want to help us lower health care costs. And they started demanding restrictions on abortion, something that had never been an issue before in our talks until then, and used that pretext to torpedo months of bipartisan negotiations. Excuse my skepticism today when we've seen this tired playbook. If Republicans want to talk about health care, great. Unfortunately, we've heard many Republicans make it clear they're not serious. But if that changes, I'm at the table. I am at the table. I'm ready to talk about our health care system in this country. So, Dr. Feagin, let me talk to you. Did any of the cuts Republicans made in their reconciliation bill this summer make health care more affordable for American families?
They did not.
Can you tell us why?
The reality is that when we make people pay more for their deductibles, that they don't get care. The reality is, when we say we're going to give them a medical savings account, the only choice patients have is to purchase health insurance. And so it puts them right back in. When you're purchasing health insurance on an individual basis, it's more expensive than if you're having part of a large pool. When you have to, the only way that you get a cheaper price is when you agree to have a greater deductible or greater out-of-pocket expenses, and you have fewer choices. So they didn't save any money, and giving the money to the patients doesn't help the patients make better decisions.
Okay. And we heard a lot of discussion about coverage more affordable for small businesses and employers. I think what is important to acknowledge is that nearly half of the adults within the ACA marketplace are small business owners or employees or self-employed, and letting these tax cuts expire is going to hurt them dramatically. I do want to note that tomorrow, CDC's vaccine committee is meeting to discuss the childhood vaccine schedule and the hepatitis B vaccines, something the chair of this committee has said many times saves lives. The CDC advisory committee is going to hear from who knows who, but based on the fact that the CDC's own website now spreads anti-vax disinformation, I want to state for the record, I am deeply alarmed. This committee has not done more oversight, and we still have not done a thing to force RFK Jr. to come here and answer questions about his decision to fire the CDC director, Menares, and limit access to life-saving changes. And I hope that will change.
Washington County for All and Unite Oregon held an immigration town hall, encouraging people to know their rights and prepare their families as attacks on immigrants continue.
Rapid response. You've heard these guys talk about it. Hopefully all of you are leaving with the PERCA hotline to know how to call and to get support. Some of you might decide to engage in Migra Watch, which is trying to show up and be present to either confirm ICE is there and to observe as ICE engages and connecting to resources. And then we're moving into the community care. We've had over 300 families supported. And if there's one thing I can ask you to do today, is to humanize these 300 people, because I think the federal government has called them a lot of pretty horrible names, criminals, problematic people. I have not met a single person or a single family member who is either a criminal or the kind of criminal that folks are saying doesn't deserve to live here or doesn't deserve justice or doesn't deserve peace. And so if I can ask you to think about humanizing the people that have been taken, we have seen U.S. citizens been taken. We have seen people with status taken. We have seen people with no criminal records taken. We've also seen people that might have had some sort of infraction that have been taken, but they've done their time, and yet they're still being taken, and taken very violently, and that's not okay. We believe in due process in this country, and we believe in rights.
Research shows about 160 million Americans need vision correction and are not getting it. Experts estimate that tens of thousands of children in Oregon do not have the corrective glasses they need in order to see well, leading them to fall behind academically. Often vision care is not accessible to people in low-income communities. Now, as Isabel Charlotte reports, a movement is growing in the state and globally to provide people with the vision care they need.
A movement to recognize the importance of vision care as a means to fight poverty is growing in Oregon and across the world. About 93,000 students across the state go to school every day without the glasses they need to be able to participate fully. Matt Giannino with Good Vision USA explains that if a child's vision problem goes unaddressed, their academic performance quickly begins to decline, leading to fewer job opportunities.
They're less likely to attend school. They're less likely to complete school. On average, students with vision impairment that go unaddressed lose between 2 and 4 months of learning every year.
Almost 1 billion people worldwide need glasses but cannot afford them, what Giannino calls the planet's greatest unmet disability. His organization has already treated 1 million patients across 11 countries. He stresses that vision care is a high-impact opportunity, with research showing a $28 return for every dollar invested. Ann Hollister is with Vision to Learn, a nonprofit that provides vision care and glasses to kids at schools in low-income communities. She says upwards of 95% of the kids who need glasses don't have them, adding that many kids and parents simply don't realize their children are not able to see.
The first time we give a child glasses, they so often say the same thing. They put them on, they take them off for a second, and they put them back on, and they tell us they didn't know the tree had leaves.
Hollister notes that even with Medicaid covering vision care in Oregon, it remains inaccessible for many. Working parents often have to miss work for multiple appointments to get their children screened and fitted for glasses. Since launching in Portland in 2023, Vision to Learn has provided glasses to around 4,200 kids and plans to expand across the state. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
President Trump tries to justify Venezuelan boat strike survivor deaths as just part of war. The ACA subsidy deadline fuels debates on health care affordability, and the Trump administration threatens to withhold SNAP funds for Democratic-led states not providing recipient data. For the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2025 Talks.
I think you're going to find that this is war, that these people were killing our people by the millions, actually, if you look over a few years. I think last year, close to 300,000 people were killed.
President Donald Trump calls dead boat strike survivors hit while clinging helplessly to floating wreckage normal casualties of war. Venezuelan boats have been blown up since September for allegedly smuggling drugs, though the administration isn't offering evidence to prove the charge. Trump says a ground offensive will be next. About 80,000 Americans actually died in drug overdoses in 2024, a decline from previous years. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says in the case in question, he wasn't aware of the second strike that killed the survivors until later. He says the fire and smoke from the smoldering ship left him unable to see, calling that, quote, the fog of war. Congress is divided. While some want more answers, Senate Majority Leader John Thune says the president was acting within his legal authority to carry out the strikes, which have killed about 80 so far.
A war has been waged by these drug cartels against the United States, and it has come at a great cost to American citizens. We've lost tens of thousands of lives in just the past year to these drug cartels.
Democrats argue the follow-up attack may have violated U.S. law, especially given that no war has been declared. Stopping drug boats is typically done by the Coast Guard, generally with arrests and rarely injuries or deaths. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is demanding the unedited tapes of the boat strikes and that Hegseth testify publicly. He says Republicans need to remember only Congress can declare war.
If Trump were to order an attack on land, that would be an act of war, and Congress would invoke the War Powers Act. It's Congress's prerogative to go to war, and I hope Republicans will defend that role.
The deadline to renew Affordable Care Act subsidies is coming with their expiration and a sharp rise in insurance premiums at the end of the month. Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley says the "we just couldn't get it done, we'll try next year" attitude won't suffice given the healthcare affordability crisis.
If Congress does not take action on this issue in the next few weeks, this will be a crisis for 24 million Americans and counting. In my state, premiums are already going up between 24 and 50%, depending on the healthcare plan, depending on the region of the state.
The Trump administration says it's withholding SNAP funding from Democratic-led states if they don't provide data on recipients, including immigration status. The White House cites a recent investigation into fraud in Minnesota, mostly by members of the state's Somali community. But states and healthy food programs say tighter qualification rules and federal chaos, including the shutdown, are making it hard to do their job. In Wisconsin, Hunger Program CEO Amber Dogg says they've been blocked on a program that lets families buy from winter farmers markets. She says the situation's been bad for producers and that small rural grocery stores are also especially vulnerable when SNAP is stalled.
This prevents small rural farmers, but also grocers from being able to have the necessary funding and resources to keep their shelves stocked, their purveyors paid, and their staff employed.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A West Coast company is using pig cell biopsies to cultivate meat alternatives. This means that cells from a still healthy and living pig is being used as a starter to create cultivated pork fat. Brett Pivito has the story.
One California company developing cultivated pork is among the newest entrants in the effort to rethink meat. For years, plant-based offerings have been mimicking burgers, chicken, and fish with blends of proteins and fats. Mission Barns is one of a handful of startups growing real animal fat outside the animal, then combining the cultivated fat with plant proteins to create hybrids that look, cook, and taste more like what consumers have always eaten, easing the environmental and ethical costs of industrial livestock. Mission Barns CEO Cecilia Chang says having control over what the fat cells consume allows for improved nutrition.
We can actually create pork fat that has lower saturated fat, lower cholesterol, or has higher omega-3s, so like the healthy fats.
She says it's possible to have a bacon product with the nutritional profile of salmon. The company is starting with pork because it's a large market and products like bacon are fat rich, but its technology is cell agnostic, meaning it could create beef, chicken, or other meats. Cultivated pork begins with a small sample of fat taken from a living pig. The fat cells are then grown in a large steel tank similar to those used to brew beer. Inside, nutrients like carbohydrates, amino acids, and vitamins are fed to the cell, replicating the natural process in a pig's body. While some products like meatballs are unstructured, Chang says products like bacon with layers of muscle and fat need structure.
That's actually one of the products we've gotten really positive feedback on because a lot of the alternative plant-based bacons on the market are not that great because it's quite difficult to replicate the structured bacon streaks just using plant-based, but because we have real animal fat that allows us to really recreate that texture of bacon.
There are many factors in quantifying how much of an environmental improvement cultivated fat might offer over industrial pork production. If scaled up, one benefit of cultivated food might be location. Instead of sprawling pig farms and slaughterhouses relegated to rural areas, bioreactors could be run in cities, cutting down on the costs and emissions associated with shipping, also foregoing the methane produced by the livestock. Chang says their process represents a large reduction in greenhouse gas emissions.
When you're factoring in that we are able to rely on renewable energy, we're able to rely on more crude inputs to feed the cells. We've done our life cycle analysis. We've been able to show 70% less greenhouse gas compared to conventionally raised pork.
Mission Barns cultivated fat won FDA and USDA approval earlier this year. It's now preparing to scale up production and partner with food manufacturers who can use its cultivated fat as an ingredient. This story was produced with original reporting from Matt Simon for Grist. For California News Service, I'm Brett Pivito.
A Bush fellow from White Earth wants to level up with a law degree. And a Native family shares its restoration of a coming-of-age ceremony for girls. Here's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This year's 29 Bush Fellows included 5 Native Americans from across the upper Midwest. The Bush Fellowship provides up to $150,000 over 2 years for fellows to hone their talents and leadership skills. In the 5th of 5 profiles, Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a White Earth tribal administrator who wants to best serve his community.
Curtis Rogers is the deputy director of the White Earth Nation of Minnesota. He works with 1,300 employees who serve the tribe's 17,000 citizens and covers everything from public safety to economic development. In addition to that, he's also a husband and family man. With his Bush Fellowship, Rogers says he'd like to level up with a law degree.
And that's because every single day we have people that are coming to us, you know, and there's all kinds of jurisdictional questions. There's the big land back issues that we're facing continuously. The tax and tribal sovereignty. And I just want to lead and make decisions that are best.
Rogers remembers his family growing up in the projects of the White Earth Reservation and struggling to make ends meet. He says he aims to help his people any way he can, and part of that plan will be to help the tribe regain some of its state forest. Rogers says he hopes to start law school in the fall of 2026. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
In one Dene family, there had not been a ceremony for girls coming of age for 3 generations. Then a group of aunties, mothers, and daughters came together to restore it. First, just for family, and then for all young Alaska Native women interested in learning. They presented their work at the annual Elders and Youth Conference this fall in Anchorage. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden reports.
14-year-old Manu David is pouring hot tea blended by hand. She brings cups to women of all ages during a workshop at the Elders and Youth Conference. David and other girls made these teas during a gathering for girls coming of age called Nadoye Dayon. Her family has been reviving this Diné tradition through sharing circles. They also harvest plant medicine, make their own body products, and work on traditional skills.
It's really fun. It's just like everybody gets together and we just share anything and everything.
Helena Jacobs is one of the women leading the event and has been working with the girls during Nadoye Dayon.
The work that we're doing with them right now is healing multiple generations.
Her family started to gather every few months. About a year ago, they transitioned the family gatherings into a community event for teenage girls.
To just empower them with knowledge about their bodies and just surround them with a lot of love and support throughout these big transitions in life that can sometimes feel kind of scary or isolating.
Kimalik Teeter is Yupik and Chupik from St. Mary's. She says she came to the workshop because she wanted to learn how to guide her 4-year-old daughter. She realized that she herself still wants guidance.
You get of age of different things all throughout your life.
Teeter says that in Yupik culture, the ceremonies celebrate different milestones, like when a woman catches her first fish, makes her first thing, and has her first baby. Teeter says that the workshop reminded her that it's not too late to honor transitions in her life.
Maybe, deep down, I just really wanted this for me, not just for my baby. So,
the workshop closed with two activities. Women and girls wrote affirmation for themselves and others and connected them by a string. They also made heating pads filled with rice and fragrances. In Anchorage, I'm Alona Naiden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Thanks so much for listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 4th, 2025.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings and Josh Salem.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service.